Speak up.
You're listening to Speak Up on CJSF 90.1 FM Burnaby. We're the campus and community radio station at Simon Fraser University, where we broadcast from unceded Coast Salish territories.
Good morning and welcome to Speak Up for Tuesday, November 28th. My name is Magnus Tiefeld. I'm your host for this morning, and we have some interesting stuff lined up for you. We have part two of our interview about democratic teaching and learning with Dr. Joanna Ashworth. We have a very interesting audio clip. The only extant recording of Virginia Woolf. It is a little segment from a radio interview from way back in the 1930s, I believe it was taken, 1937, part of a series of interviews she did around that time as part of a program on the BBC. And this is a segment and part of the only although there are several segments, there's only one extant recording and the only one of her voice. We also have an interesting documentary about attachment theory and some great music. So let's get on with the show. Yesterday, if you were tuned in, you will have caught part one of our interview with Joanna Ashworth about democratic teaching and learning. Something they're trying to promote here at SFU, and about a study looking at how instructors at SFU incorporate that into their classroom teaching. Now, if you listened yesterday, we're going to repeat the first part of the interview where Dr. Ashworth talks a bit about the study and her research and the work they're doing. This provides a nice sort of context for the other part of the interview. So if you were listening yesterday, it may start off the same, but it will end up with a transition into part two of the interview. But for those of you who weren't listening yesterday and are listening today, that first bit just provides some I think valuable context for the rest of the interview. So this is Dr. Joanna Ashworth speaking on democratic teaching and learning. Welcome to Dr. Joanna Ashworth. You are a research associate with the Community Engaged Research Initiative at Simon Fraser University, and you've been doing research into democracy in the classroom. Perhaps you can introduce yourself first, and then we'll talk a bit more about your research.
Yeah, thank you. Thanks for having me. So as you say, I'm a research associate with CERI, Community Engaged Research Initiative, which is a really interesting unit within the university that looks at and partners with communities around issues of concern for those communities, brings kind of a matchmaking of researchers from the university to communities around specific issues. And I've been there for a few years working on various projects, but the reason why I landed there is because I've been working for many years on this project called Participedia.net, which is a global study of a SHRC-funded global study of innovations in participatory democracy. And so it's documenting the kinds of things that are really trying to create a more participatory, more deliberative, more actively engaged democratic system in various parts of the world in many contexts. And it's just looking at what works, why, and where. And so through that work and through the kind of research that I have been oriented towards, which has always been community driven, I was invited to come to CERI and do some projects there. So the research on democratic teaching and learning really came out of my Participedia work. And I was invited by the VP of research at the time, who was Joy Johnson, to do, to conduct this study, which was looking at the practice of democratic teaching and learning at Simon Fraser University. Mm-hmm. And of course, there's lots of great examples at SFU where teaching and learning is very innovative, like the semester in dialogue, the city studio project, the labs that the health labs that have been done in Surrey with Paola Ardiles. And there's so many people that are kind of well known for doing really innovative work that engages communities, that looks at issues that of their concern, which I really see as kind of the heart of democratic teaching and learning, is looking at where we can have agency and looking at where we can make a difference in terms of what's happening in a particular setting, in a particular context or policy arena. So this study really was meant to be a kind of a phenomenology of who's doing work kind of in the privacy of their classrooms, not necessarily mm-hmm. in these high profile programs, but, you know, behind the doors of the classroom, what's happening? What are these instructors, whether they're full professors or sessionals, what are they doing that's innovative in terms of bringing a more democratic approach to the pedagogies that they are working with? So that was really the beginning of the study. And I worked with a number of colleagues, including Brenda Morrison, Am Johal, Paola Ardiles, Tara Mahoney, and together we kind of designed the research. And mm-hmm. We found 12 people within the university that are kind of known or who have made themselves known because of the work that they're doing, and not necessarily really well known outside of their discipline, let's say. And we spent a lot of time talking to them through these semi-structured interviews and gathered those transcripts and did a survey of SFU-wide survey, anyone that was teaching, of PhD students to full professors. We didn't get a huge response. We got 31 respondents and who completed the full survey. And so from that, we ascertained some, you know, some premises that we've been building on. So we did our research. We created a report, and then part of our commitment to the VP of research was to have a symposium. Of course, this was right mm-hmm. in the middle of COVID. So,
of course,
most of our plans went sideways, but we held a symposium online, and we took some of these ideas. And one of the strong ideas that came out of the research was that the classroom should be boundless, you know, mm-hmm. that a democratic classroom is really a boundless classroom.
Yeah. Testing 1, 2, 3. And now we pick up the interview from where we left off yesterday. Over the course of, I think any student over the course of their, you know, doing their undergrad or graduate studies has sort of encountered that situation where they're not sure whether they should be challenging the professor or they should just be repeating back to what they know the professor wants to hear. So how did some of the people you talked to for this study, you know, how did they challenge that? Because it's probably often not easy for a professor to see that from their side of it.
That's a really good question. And I think I remember one of the interviews, what the professor said was, I'm very transparent with my thought process. I share with the students what it takes to, bring a speaker in, you know, how I've negotiated that, you know, I just don't, present the speaker and say, you know, as if it doesn't take work. So he's very transparent about how he has designed or come to decisions. And he's also really transparent about how he expects students to share their thinking. What is their mm-hmm. critique of the program? What is their critique of his work? And he kind of sets a kind of an ambiance in which that's okay. And I think, you know, where I see a lot of faculty doing great work is that they kind of set the conditions for their classroom by helping students co-create what are the rules of engagement in this classroom. You know, it's very rare, and I taught classes in dialogue for many years, and the first thing that we would do, and these were fourth year communication students, is let's talk about how we're going to learn together, how we're going to do this, and, you know, what's going to make this work for you. And so they get a chance to kind of share the rules of engagement and co-create them, and then we can use them as a guide. Are we actually listening to each other? Are we allowing different points of view to surface here? Are we kind of shutting that down? Are we, you know, are more people getting airtime than others? You know, whatever they've agreed to, you know, we kind of hold each other accountable. But for many, that was like the first time that they were invited to do that, and to even invited to learn about each other and their experiences and their, you know, the things that they were bringing into the class. You know, they're fourth year students. They've got a lot of life experience, but often that's not considered. And so I think the professors that we talk to recognize that experience is important as part of the teaching and learning experience.
And it seems like this would be really important, I think for everybody, but, you know, particularly for students who are considering continuing on to more advanced degrees where, you know, by the time you're at the master's and the PhD level, you know, that kind of challenging of things is going to be very much expected of you and probably very much a key to your success in those frames.
Mm. Yeah, so this is good. It's a good grounding. And yes, we did talk to all the faculty that we talked to. They teach both undergrad and grad, and they don't seem to differentiate. Like, that's what's really unique about them, the way in which they kind of set up their classrooms and the way that they think about the how of their teaching versus the what. You know, they try to encourage that kind of critical, participatory, dialogic, you know, negotiation, orientation in their students, which I think are all fundamental to what we think of as a more engaged, more deliberative, participatory democracy, you know, where power, and sometimes you do have to fight for power. And, you know, sometimes you do, you know, students are invited to critique the professor. That's not an easy thing to do. I mean, nobody really wants to do that in everyday life. So finding a way to do it respectfully and to actually own it, to give good reasons, you know, not just have an opinion, but to give good reasons for your arguments, for your viewpoint. I think that is all part of it. But the other side of that is relationships and caring for the students. And I think more and more instructors are recognizing how stressed students are, and they're coming, it's very, you know, with a lot of other challenges that are, you know, very much part of their learning experience. And you know, they've got jobs, they've got, you know, financial issues, housing issues. So caring about the students as people and as humans, and recognizing, I think, which is in sort of the true democratic sense, recognizing each other as equals, equal of, you know, needing support and care, but also recognizing the importance of critique and argument and dialogue, all of those things, and creating that kind of space for lively kinds of learning experiences.
Right.
Yeah.
So at the top, you mentioned how, you know, in many respects, democracy seems very much under threat today. And I think we can all see that just looking around at you know, the state of debate and politics and you know, information sharing and journalism. How do we take these ideas and what is the intended outcome or impact of having these in the classroom and spreading that out into the world? Because I think we all understand that, you know, the education system, both at the secondary level or post-secondary level and for elementary and at all levels, is really one of the main bulwarks of a democratic system.
Yeah, absolutely. I think that, you know, you can just see in the states, in the more, you know, the Republican states are really paying attention to education because they recognize that, you know, how students are educated is going to impact the kind of citizens that they become. So they're shutting down and, you know, banning books and doing all sorts of things that we, you know, it's shocking to see. So I think on the flip side, obviously we know what's happening in classrooms. It does make a difference. So what we are hearing is, you know, students are learning through the kinds of assignments that they're getting or that they're co-creating with their other students or with their instructors, that these kinds of assignments actually are meaningful, and that they can see that they can actually change the circumstances of people's lives by doing research, by co-examining issues together. So they I think they recognize that, you know, what they do matters. And I think more and more, I think that's the kind of education we need to be paying attention to, and that universities need to be fostering in as many ways as possible. And I think SFU does a pretty good job in some cases, but I just think not all of the respondents to the survey, for example, thought that this was anything to do, you know, that just should be anything that we should be thinking about. This is like, let's just stick to our discipline and let us have our autonomy, and, you know, just leave things as they are. And I think we're noticing that students are just not as engaged as they could be. I think they've got a lot of distractions. They've got their phones. They've got, you know, they can do anything. They've got AI, you know, which is helping them think through a lot of complex issues and not necessarily doing the hard work of figuring things out the way that I think really sticks. So I think we've got to do things differently. And yeah, we've got to find ways to say, you know, this classroom and these assignments actually should make a difference. And that, but then that comes back to, okay, what are the things that make that difficult for instructors? Right. And I think there's some really, you know, fundamental material reasons why it doesn't happen. You know, classroom size, funding to support extra speakers or field trips and that kind of thing. But I think on the positive side, I think there's a lot that can be done through an orientation and through colleagues talking to each other and sharing their experiences. And I think that's what our study is, you know, aiming to do. I think it came out during the pandemic and we haven't had the traction, but, you know, since the symposium, just releasing the report on the symposium, which took these ideas and especially I think the big idea was this idea of the boundless classroom, that outside of the walls of our institutions, we need to really find ways for students to engage and to learn, you know, make what they do matter. No throwaway assignments, you know, no single use assignments.
Yeah. So, the report is actually pretty accessible. I've had a chance to look at it myself. I think for folks who are interested in learning more about this, it's pretty accessible to a lay reader. Can you tell us a bit more how they might be able to find it?
Yeah, it's actually, I was doing this research and I still do work with the Faculty of Environment, but it is, if you Google democratic teaching and learning at Simon Fraser University, you'll land on the page where the report is located. And I think what I found is that the faculty had so many specific suggestions about how to do this work. You know, I think I mentioned earlier about, you know, moving the furniture around. But it's also about just thinking a little bit differently about sharing the control, the rules, the process, and the content of what your course is. Encouraging more dialogue, more community building, like seeing that as important and as a way for students to learn in a much more collaborative way. Linking course content to the real world. I mean, we're all real and we come into classrooms with all our concerns and issues. Like that in itself is a great place to begin. Changing the furniture, but like engaging resource people, bringing people from the community into the classroom, going out and visiting different sites. You know, all that takes resources and planning, but I think the teachers that are successful at that have done that over time. And it, you know, it does take time. And some, you know, some had said we would appreciate having more, you know, staff support that kind of work, that our faculties encourage it. They recognize the value of it and they know that it's more time consuming, but the impacts are significant. So
are you able to, you know, have you been able to get the ear and have some influence on, you know, both the way that university level educators are trained to work in the classroom, but also through, you know, SFU has as a education program and is, you know, one of the leaders in preparing teachers for the elementary and secondary systems. Do you see this, you know, this research and having influence there?
Well, I think if you think about democracy as sort of a broad array of, you know, capacities and virtues, and I think one of them is around justice. Yes. And I've seen, and we collaborated with the Center for Restorative Justice, Brenda Morrison and others out in the community that do restorative justice in classrooms, and it's mostly K to 12 classrooms. Mm-hmm. I see that as a really powerful means in which teachers are becoming trained to do that work, to help students with conflicts, to work through conflict in really, really constructive ways. But there's, you know, there's so much more that could be done.
Right.
So we haven't really tackled, you know, K to 12. What we started with was, you know, what can we do in higher education? What is right. our responsibility? Where are we making some really innovative progress? And what else could we be thinking about? And I think that the Center for Excellence in Teaching, I might have gotten that wrong because the name of that unit that supports teaching and learning at yeah. the university is paying attention to a lot of the related issues,
yeah.
particularly equity, diversity, and inclusion, mm-hmm. which obviously are huge parts of when we think about democracy and democratic systems. Yeah. We have to think about inclusion and yep. diversity. And I think that is one of our big challenges. And when we think about diversity in the classroom, we have to think about faculty, you know, how diverse is our faculty?
Yep.
Does it represent the diversity of our student body? So those are all questions I think that the university at the highest levels is looking at and paying attention to, is quite aware of. And that does affect your ability, you know, teaching and learning at the level of the classroom.
Right.
Sure.
Great. Are you planning further research and initiatives in this area?
Right now, we are just wrapping up this CIRC funded work that we did with the symposium.
Yeah.
And I think there is a lot more to do. I think one of the key ways is by bringing faculty together across the country through all our networks, like Participedia, through CIRI, through Restorative Justice networks, to figure out ways that we can, you know, foster a culture of democratic teaching and learning. And,
right.
you know, there's a lot going on. And I think making those conversations more inclusive and not just the people that are already, you know, on board, but yeah. those faculty that maybe don't really think that's relevant to them, but, you know, maybe if they got a little bit involved, they might find it useful and not something that's critiquing their work, but could really expand
right.
the impact that they're having. So.
Great. Well, so much. Thank you so much for speaking to me today. I think this is a really interesting topic, and it'll be interesting to see where things go with it in the future. Obviously, you know, the whole issue of democracy in our society is pretty important these days, and this is sounds like it's, you know, finding ways to support that.
Yeah, I think so. And yeah, thanks very much for your interest. I hope people read the report, and I hope there's some really specific ideas that they can run with, but also to, you know, share what they know and what they do with other, I think is a really good way to move this forward.
Great. Thank you for speaking with me today.
Yeah, nice to talk to you.
And thank you to Dr. Joanna Ashworth for speaking with me on this issue. She is a research associate with the Center for Engaged Research Initiatives here at SFU and active in a number of different areas at the university. They've been doing, she talked a bit about in the interview, symposiums with educators and students here at SFU to sort of spread the word about this research and some of the ideas that are brought forth. The study that we've been talking about, Democratic Teaching and Learning, a study of practice at Simon Fraser University, is a pretty accessible report. And if you're interested in learning more about the subject, you can find that report online on the SFU website just by Googling Democratic Teaching and Learning SFU, and you should be able to find it pretty easily. So thanks to Dr. Joanna Ashworth for that really interesting interview. If you're interested in hearing part one, it is available on our website at www.cgsf.ca, and this program and this interview will be posted up on our website later today. All right, you're listening to CGSF 90.1 FM. This is a Speak Up. I am your host, Magnus Tevold. Next up is something from Canadian singer-songwriter Hannah Georges. She has a new album came out this summer, which is called I'd Be Lying If I Said I Didn't Care. And this is the lead-off single from that album, our lead-off track, and it is called Scratch.
Stir from scratch. How do I do that? How do I make sense of everything I thought I had and was and lost? And I've been looking for I thought I was, and I've been looking for. Everything I thought I had.
Hannah Georges, and Scratch from her album, I'd Be Lying If I Said I Didn't Care. Our next segment is a clip of famed English author Virginia Woolf. This is the only, it's a segment from the only existing recording of her voice. She is, of course, a seminal essayist and thinker and feminist and author from the early part of the 20th century. This recording was originally broadcast in April 1937, part of a longer interview. This is just a clip of it, but it's a significant clip. Let's give it a listen here. This is Virginia Woolf.
Virginia Woolf.
It is them we hear. It is them we see. Only after the right eye is dead do his words to some extent, only to some extent, become disinfected, purified of the accidents of the living body. Now, this power of suggestion is one of the most exciting and most mysterious properties of words. Most exciting if you are a person in the habit of using them. Everyone who has ever written a sentence must be conscious or half conscious of it. Words, English words, are full of echoes, memories, associations, naturally. They've been out and about on people's lips, in their houses, in the streets, in the fields, for so many centuries. And that is one of the chief difficulties in writing in today. They're stored with other meanings, with other memories, and they have contracted so many famous marriages in the past. The splendid word incarnadine, for example, who can use that without remembering multitudinous seas? In the old days, of course, when English was a new language, writers could invent new words and use them. Nowadays, it's easy enough to invent new words. They spring to the lips whenever we see a new sight or feel a new sensation. But we cannot use them because the English language is old. You cannot use a brand new word in an old language because of the very obvious, yet always mysterious fact that a word is not a single and separate entity. It is part of other words. Indeed, it is not a word until it is part of a sentence. Words belong to each other. Although, of course, only a great poet knows that the word incarnadine belongs to multitudinous seas. To combine new words with old words is fatal to the constitution of the sentence. In order to use new words properly, you would have to invent a whole new language, and that, though no doubt we shall come to it, is not at the moment our business. Our business is to see what we can do with the old English language as it is. How can we combine the old words in new orders so that they survive, so that they create beauty, so that they tell the truth? That is the question. And the person who could answer that question would deserve whatever crown of glory the world has to offer. Think what it would mean if you could teach or if you could learn the art of writing. Why, every book, every newspaper you pick up would tell the truth or would create beauty. But there is, it would appear, some obstacle in the way, some hindrance to the teaching of words. For though at this moment at least 100 professors are lecturing on the literature of the past, at least 1,000 critics are reviewing the literature of the present, and hundreds upon hundreds of young men and women are passing examinations in English literature with the utmost credit, still, do we write better? Do we read better than we read and wrote 400 years ago when we were unlectured, uncriticized, untaught? Is our modern Georgian literature a patch on the Elizabethan? Well, where are we to lay the blame? Not on our professors, not on our reviewers, not on our writers, but on words. It is words that are to blame. They are the wildest, freest, most irresponsible, most unteachable of all things. Of course, you can catch them and sort them and place them in alphabetical order in dictionaries. But words do not live in dictionaries. They live in the mind. If you want proof of this, consider how often, in moments of emotion, when we most need words, we find none. Yet there is a dictionary. There at our disposal are some 500,000 words, all in alphabetical order. But can we use them? No, because words do not live in dictionaries, they live in the mind. Look once more at the dictionary. There, beyond a doubt, lie plays more splendid than Antony and Cleopatra, poems lovely on the ode to a nightingale, novels beside which Pride and Prejudice or David Copperfield are the crude bunglings of amateurs. It's only a question of finding the right words and putting them in the right order. We can't do it because they do not live in dictionaries, they live in the mind. And how do they live in the mind? Variously and strangely, much as human beings live, ranging hither and thither, falling in love, meeting together. It is true they are much less bound by ceremony and convention than we are. Royal words meet with commoners. English words marry French words, German words, Indian words, Negro words, if they have a fancy. Indeed, the less we inquire into the past of our dear mother English, the better it will be for that lady's reputation, for she has gone a roving fair maid. Thus, to lay down any laws for such irreclaimable vagabonds is worse than useless. A few trifling rules of grammar and spelling is all the constraint we can put on them. All we can say about them as we peer at them over the edge of that deep, dark, and only fitfully illuminated cavern in which they live, the mind, all we can say about them is that they seem to like people to think before they use them and to feel before they use them. But to think and to feel not about them, about something different. They are highly sensitive, easily made self-conscious. They do not like to have their purity or their impurity discussed. If you start a society for pure English, they will show their resentment by starting another for impure English. Hence the unnatural violence of much modern speech, the protest against the Puritans. They are highly democratic, too. They believe that one word is as good as another. Uneducated words, as good as educated words. Uncultivated words, as good as cultivated words. There are no ranks or titles in their society. Nor do they like being lifted on the point of a pen and examined separately. They hang together in sentences, paragraphs, sometimes for whole pages at a time. Then they hate being useful. They hate making money. They hate being lectured about in public. In short, they hate anything that stamps them with one meaning or confines them to one attitude, for it is our nature to change. Perhaps that is our most striking peculiarity, their need of change. It is because the truth they try to catch is many-sided, and they convey it by being many-sided, flashing first this way, then that. Thus they mean one thing to one person, another thing to another person. They are unintelligible to one generation, plain as a pikestaff to the next. And it is because of this complexity, this power to mean different things to different people, that they survive. Perhaps then one reason why we have no great poet, novelist, or critic writing today is that we refuse to allow words their liberty. We pin them down to one meaning, their useful meaning, the meaning which makes us catch the train, the meaning which makes us pass the examination.
Virginia Woolf, author and essayist and feminist. That was the only existing recording of her voice from a radio broadcast in 1937, part of a series released by the British Library and the BBC, a three CD collection of interviews and spoken parts from famous British authors. And we may visit this one again. It's got a lot of interesting little clips in there. All right, we're going to go on with the show. You're listening to CJSF 90.1 FM. And next up is one of our favorites, Bird Note.
This is Bird Note. Giant owls once walked the earth.
As recently as 10,000 years ago, these owls, now extinct, were among the largest of all known owls, standing 3.5 feet tall and weighing 20 pounds. They thrived among the top predators on the island of Cuba. But the wings of the Cuban giant owl were surprisingly small. They may have powered the bird up to low perches, but scientists think it hunted primarily on foot. Running on long, powerful legs, equipped with large talons, the bird ambushed or chased down its prey. The owls appear to have evolved their remarkable size and ground-dwelling habits at a time when Cuba had no large carnivorous mammals to compete with. Very little is known about why they died out. Fossils of similar owls, with long legs and small wings, have been unearthed in places as disparate as Hawaii and Georgia, pointing to large terrestrial owls as a widespread, successful adaptation. But from any angle, the Cuban giant owl was a behemoth among owls, an example of evolution pushed to the extreme. For BirdNote, I'm Michael Stein. Want more BirdNote sounds, images, and stories delivered straight to your inbox? Subscribe to our weekly newsletter for a preview of the week's shows, stories, and stunning photos every Friday morning. Visit birdnote.org to sign up today.
Hey, SFU! Getting money back for all your empty or refundable bottles and cans just got a lot easier. Just sign up for Returned Express for free. You can bag your containers, tag the bag, and drop it through the window at the new Express and Go container in the East parking lot. Return It will count your containers and credit your refunds to your online account. Learn more at returnit.ca/SFU.
My best and most healthy relationship snuck up on me. I was in my late teens and started the relationship thinking I'd have a summer fling and maybe learn a little bit about dating in the process. I told myself, I'll dump him in September when school starts again. And then I ended up falling in love with him. We were together 5.5 years. Since then, I've had a string of relationships where the driving force was passion. It starts out strong with a blast of wild intensity and an all-encompassing fervor, but they end up being emotionally unavailable. I wanted to know what was happening and found some answers in attachment theory, which is research on the types of people we're attracted to and what happens when we get together. After delving into the attachment research, I started to purposefully date people who were better for me, but this came with much less excitement and passion. I found the process a little discouraging and a bit overwhelming. Dating like this was new territory. I became interested in doing a story on dating differently. I was curious about how this worked for others, and then I happened to bump into Mark at a party. He had gone through something similar, and he was willing to share his story. Mark and Eileen were set up by a couple of friends, and it was a bit awkward at first.
It was kind of a strange thing. It's, you know, when your parents tell you to talk to their friend's kid, it felt a bit like that, kind of a forced conversation.
As Mark will say, he felt obligated to talk to me.
Regardless, they ended up staying up most of the night and even took in the sunrise together. But it wasn't an instant connection. They went out a couple more times, but they didn't really pursue each other. After some prodding from friends on both sides, they start to date a bit more consistently.
In the beginning, I have to say part of it was that I kept thinking to myself, Mark's kind of crazy and he does all these wild things, but like he has very down-to-earth, lovely friends. And that was kind of like a stabilizing factor where I was like, you know what, I'm going to like see what's going on with this guy. Because I felt like he had some great characteristics. We had a lot of fun together. We had some stuff in common, but there were certain things like the lack of commitment and other things that would drive me a bit crazy.
Things like Mark finding it hard to commit to any plans with Eileen in case something better came along, or about how she'd barely see Mark when they went to parties together because he'd be off socializing and only realize he hadn't spoken to her all night when she'd find him to say goodnight. And these were the early days where you might expect just the opposite.
It was like pretty early on, like it must have been at like about a month or something. And I just said very casually to Mark, how do you think things are going? Which I thought was like a very normal question to ask someone that you had dated a bunch of times and seen a couple times a week for a month. And he like took this long pause. And then he was like, well, I'd say I'm about 60% into you.
In my mind, I tend to think in terms of, I guess, too much like an engineer. And so I was trying to explain my rationale in terms of the way I'd been thinking previously about relationships starting at 100% and only dwindling. So trying to explain to her that, you know, I'm not at 100%, but it's increasing.
And I was so taken aback because first, definitely wasn't expecting a number. Like, I had not expected him to like quantify it in numerical form. Secondly, I felt like 60 seemed like really low.
It's on the right side of 50% was what I was thinking. And it was only going to increase from there.
And he seemed like pretty delighted with this. And then he followed up by, no, well, it started way lower. I mean, I don't think like I'm an egoist, but at the same time, I don't feel like, you know, I need to be at a place where it's like, oh, well, look what the cat dragged in. Like, you know, I was also someone who's used to being a fairly high achiever. And to me, like 60 didn't seem that good. And I didn't really want to like know that. But that kind of speaks to Mark's like brutal honesty. He'll just say it like it is, you know.
Most of Mark's previous relationships started off quite differently. He was swept away by excitement and passion. They'd hook up and fall into relationship within a week's time, but they didn't last long.
I kind of notoriously had like a 3-month limit for my relationships and then would move on.
This is where attachment theory might come in handy. It's a psychological model that attempts to describe the dynamics of long and short-term relationships between humans. It's actually really accurate at predicting how people will behave in romantic relationships and whether they'll be matched based on their attachment styles. I found it immensely illuminating in my own life. It gave some context to the pattern I started to become aware of, one of being attracted to emotionally unavailable men and also being somewhat turned off people who were just the opposite and were available and present. Considering I've been a therapist for 10 years, you could say I came upon this info embarrassingly late, but I guess it's always easier to see what's happening in someone else's life than your own. There are 4 attachment types. People with a secure attachment are warm and loving. Relationships come easily to them, and they're great at communicating their needs and feelings. They're also comfortable with intimacy and independence. They're like the gold standard. People with an anxious attachment tend to be stressed out about their relationships. They love being very close to their partners, and they have the capacity for a lot of intimacy. However, they need a lot of reassurance and affection. People with an avoidant attachment style are fiercely independent and are often uncomfortable with intimacy. For them, the idea of commitment can be scary. They often construct their lifestyle in order to avoid commitment or too much intimate contact. So even though they want to be in relationship, they tend to keep their distance. The last attachment style is the combination of anxious and avoidant. With this type, the person is uncomfortable with intimacy and commitment, and at the same time, they have a strong desire to be in relationship. So how exactly do these attachment styles develop? They're actually formed through interactions with our parents as infants. Mark's 3-month relationships unfolded in relatively the same way. The first month was fun and full of passion. The second month, as Mark put it, they'd be coasting. And by the 3rd month, things already started to feel a bit old. No longer in the honeymoon phase, he would get antsy and bored. Small superficial things that his partner did would start to annoy him.
It was really silly. It was just like wearing the same ratty pants over and over. It was just something that I noticed that stood out. No longer kind of this perfect image that I had of the person.
Through the attachment theory lens, our reactions to our partner's small imperfections would be seen as an avoidant type's distancing reaction to the idea of commitment. And this can all happen subconsciously.
And that's where I noticed also that it wasn't so much about the person, but it was also about me and how I approached the relationships. I realized if I want to have a relationship that lasted longer than 3 months, I needed to learn to appreciate those things and be able to accept how a person is. I think it was just realizing that after seeing that pattern numerous times, that it wasn't sustainable and this can't be how you build a long-term relationship.
I asked Mark and Eileen to read over a summary on attachment styles to see where they identified themselves on the attachment spectrum.
Maybe Eileen can answer better for me.
Yeah, that'd be interesting.
He definitely started out with feeling uncomfortable when things are too close and intimate and valuing independence and freedom. Yeah. Yeah, definitely. This is like classic. Mark is always surprised when I say something that I think is like completely obvious. I'll be like, oh, well, Mark really likes, you know, chicken. He's like, chicken? What do you mean I like chicken?
I guess I don't see myself in any boxes. So when someone sees me in a box, I'm always surprised by it.
Mark's reaction is understandable. Even though we may have a dominant attachment style, it's on a spectrum. So in most cases, we can have a bit of all styles in varying quantities. I take a guess that Mark would fall into the avoidant category. And Eileen sounds like a mixture of anxious and secure. You can see it playing out, where Mark's more distant at first, and Eileen's looking for reassurance while still remaining grounded. I'm simplifying this all a bit, but you get it. There are predictable ways that the different attachment types tend to configure themselves into relationships. Secure types are capable of dating both anxious and avoidant types. They're comfortable enough with themselves to give anxious types all the reassurance they need and to give avoidant types the space they need without feeling threatened themselves. But opposites also attract. Anxious types are drawn to avoidant types and vice versa. For anxious types, avoidant types validate their abandonment fears and an insecurity of not being enough. In turn, avoidant types need someone to pursue them to meet the emotional needs that they subconsciously disown. I learned through my research that I was stuck in what's called the anxious-avoidant trap. I was the anxious one in this scenario. It was explained that I was attracted to avoidant types because they activated my attachment system. The attachment system is needed for survival. It's the system responsible for babies attaching to their caregivers. And it's the same system working in romantic relationships. So as an anxious person, getting mixed messages from an avoidant type and the tension that can arise from that activates the attachment system, which puts the person into overdrive to make the relationship work. And the feeling created in that reaction can get mixed up for feelings of like or love. And the other hard part is that if an anxious type meets someone who's secure and much better suited, the attachment system doesn't get activated. There's less drama, which can cause feelings of boredom. So if you're an anxious type, there's a good chance you'll automatically interpret calmness in the relationship as lack of attraction.
I would say Mark is like very comfortable with intimacy, and I'd say that you don't obsess where the relationship's going or my ability to love you back. I would say he's moved towards this.
Meaning secure attachment.
For me, I would probably have started out more with like having some insecurity about where the relationship was going, and some of the things Mark did like really setting me off and driving me crazy. So more in the anxious and then gone more into the secure. We started in different boxes but ended up in the same one.
And that's exactly what can happen. Our attachment styles aren't fixed, thank goodness. They may lead us astray at points, but it's possible to develop a secure attachment at any age. Change occurs mostly when you get into a relationship that really shakes your beliefs about love. If, for example, you expect people to let you down or reject you once they get to know the real you, and then you meet someone who's supportive and loving no matter what, over time, you'll likely become more secure. So even though we don't have control over the type of attachment style that gets formed in infancy, we're not doomed.
I think I remember the turning point there. It was a discussion where we had where, I guess a lot of couples have that, their like first fight, but then realizing that the person's going to stick through it. And I think that's where things probably kind of changed. Whereas in my previous relationships, it would have been like, okay, time to move on. Whereas this then was like, oh, okay, well, even if things are rough, this person's going to stick it out and we'll figure it out and work through it. I guess it just, for me, was not a pattern that I had been used to in my previous relationships. And so knowing that having a fight wasn't the end of the relationship was, I think, a really positive thing.
What was it that showed you, hey, this isn't going to be the end of us?
I think it was her reaction saying, you know, that we're not breaking up. Just even hearing that was a very good thing for me to hear. And I'm holding her to it now. And now we're at the point where I like talking about things a lot more than Eileen does.
Yeah, Mark's an excellent communicator.
I have to admit, I was disappointed by their story. Even a bit bored. Was that it? No big ups and downs. No big revelations. Just two people growing together and finally realizing their opposite traits are complementary. And then I realized I was still chasing excitement. If not through my own story, but through others. And it's not about excitement. It's about companionship, which can still involve excitement. Mark and Eileen have tons of fun together. They play, they joke. They're cool folks. In my own life, trying to break the pattern hasn't been easy. I've come up with the term dating in the middle to describe my experience. I'm trying not to run after fireworks, but I also need to feel something. So I guess that's the middle. But it's all still pretty new. When I meet someone nice and attractive enough, who I might not feel wildly excited about, I think, give this a chance. But also, I keep reminding myself that distance is my kryptonite. I think danger, stay away. But I'm still pulled towards it. It's not easy out there, especially when my compass has been stuck pointing north to emotionally unavailable men for years. It's going to take some time getting comfortable dating differently, but I think it might be worth it.
Part of my philosophy now in terms of being in a long committed relationship and my fear of missing out, you know, is that this is a great opportunity to have this lifelong commitment to someone. And if I'm not faithful, it will actually ruin that. And that's what I'm going to be missing out. I'd be missing out on a lifelong partner and building a life together with someone. And so it's just kind of turning it around, kind of using my weaknesses as a strength.
And so how many years in now?
11.
It's a long time.
Yeah.
Yeah. We're close to 100% now too.
I hope you enjoyed that presentation. That was a documentary created by CJSF Radio as part of a grant we got from the Canadian Radio Fund of Canada, or Community Radio Fund of Canada. All right, we are just about out of time here at Speak Up for today's program. Coming up, I just want to remind you about a giveaway we have. We talked about it on yesterday's show. Two tickets to Early Music Vancouver and the Vancouver Chamber Choir's presentation of Handel's Messiah at the Orpheum Theatre on December 8th. We have two tickets to give away, and you can get in the running for those tickets by emailing cjsfae@sfu.ca, and we'll choose the winners this Friday, and hopefully that will be you. So email your interest and why you'd like to go to that show. All right, that is the end of the program for today. Stay tuned for Democracy Now! Coming up in just a few minutes. We're going to finish off this program with a track from Faith Healer. This is The Game from their most recent album. Thanks for listening to Speak Up. Stay tuned for Democracy Now! Coming up right after this.
Tethered to the world becomes a tangle. It gets shorter every angle that you take. You can keep yourself alive without your tether in exile, but the breeze will still remind you of the game. So safe, it's like an anchor, and it holds you in its arm, and you feel safe. So you shied from sacrifice, your tether and your will collide. They don't fight, they just become one.